We have two matters on our agenda this morning. The first is Draft Advisory Opinion 2022-12, Ready for Ron. We have Mr. Backer here as counsel. Welcome to the hearing, sir. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, commissioners. Before you are agenda documents 22-36-A and 22-36-B, alternative draft advisory opinions responding to a request from Ready for Ron, a non-connected hybrid PAC. The requester asks whether it may provide to Governor Ron DeSantis, without charge, a petition containing the names and contact information of individuals who wish to encourage him to run for president in the 2024 election, and to provide regular updates with the contact information of additional petition signatories through the 2024 election cycle. Draft A concludes that the requester may not provide the names and contact information to Governor DeSantis, either before or after he becomes a federal candidate, because the value of that information would exceed applicable contribution limits and limits on funds used to test the waters for a federal candidacy. Draft A also concludes that the proposal is contrary to restrictions on the use of funds in hybrid PAC's non-contribution account. Draft B concludes that the requester may provide the names and contact information to Governor DeSantis before he begins testing the waters for a federal candidacy, because neither the Act nor Commission regulations prohibit such activity, but that it may not do so after he begins testing the waters or becomes a federal candidate. Draft B also concludes that the proposal is contrary to restrictions on the use of funds in a hybrid PAC's non-contribution account if the information is provided after Governor DeSantis begins testing the waters or becomes a federal candidate. We did not receive any comments on the request. We received four comments on the drafts, including one from the requester. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, counsel. Colleagues, any questions for the Office of General Counsel or for counsel to the requester? I have a few. Oh, Commissioner Cookson, please.
I'm happy to defer you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask for counsel for the requester's views on the alternative drafts, but if you have substantive questions, I think those make sense to go first.
I appreciate that, sir. Good morning, Mr. Backer. Welcome again.
Good morning.
So I've got some questions here, and we'll see how they play out. The first is, why does Ready for Ron wish to transfer not only the names on the petition, but also contact information for those names? What's the communicative value of that contact information?
Well, if you're only transferring names, how do you know that that person is actually that person and not just a name on a piece of paper? So the ability to essentially verify or engage with that individual who says, please run for office, is, I think, necessary to it could be credible.
So does Ready for Ron plan to attach conditions to the transfer of the petition?
No.
Including any conditions along the lines of you may use this contact information for verification, but not for, say, solicitation of contributions?
No, in part because should the organization be successful and should Governor DeSantis run for president, Ready for Ron is then going to begin engaging in independent expenditures in support of his presidential campaign, at which point it doesn't want to be communicating with him about what he should and shouldn't say.
Well, that probably answers my next question, but I'll ask it anyway for the record. Has Ready for Ron communicated with Governor DeSantis or any member of his staff?
No.
This is getting in sort of, just to set the table, I think, part of the question here is obviously the status of Governor DeSantis at the time the list would be transmitted. And also what I've felt is a little lack of clarity on what that process would look like. I think you see reflected in the two drafts. So I guess my first question is, has Ready for Ron identified a person to whom it intends to carry out the transmission?
On Ready for Ron's side or on the
other Ready for Ron's side? I mean, if you're going to transmit this, you have to do it somehow in practical terms. What does that look like?
I don't know that there's a plan in place for that. I would imagine it's basically a conversation or a meeting with some of the senior level people at Ready for Ron, handing over a file.
Okay.
Presumably a large stack of paper and a desk.
So the intention is to deliver it electronically and in some sort of hard copy there.
One or the other, but probably both.
So once the list is handed over, does Ready for Ron intend to keep a copy or to delete? Is there any plan for its presence with Ready for Ron after it's handed over?
Ready for Ron will retain the list as well, because it's going to need to communicate to those individuals for various get out the vote activities and to conduct independent expenditures, as well as volunteer activism, recruitment, training, et cetera.
Okay, so Ready for Ron intends to use this as a PAC asset for that better term.
I wouldn't define it as an asset, but it certainly would. It does intend to continue to use the list of supporters in order to work with people who support the potential candidacy to support the election.
Okay. There's been a fair amount of paper in this, so I may have just missed it. But is this intention to use the list for internal IE and other purposes by Ready for Ron? Is that in the request?
I don't know if that's expressly stated, but I imagine that that it's in there somewhere, that the organization is going to continue to communicate with that audience, because it's not simply going to stop existing upon delivery of the list. Partly because if it delivers a list prior to testing the waters, or at any point, and he's not yet a candidate, then they're continuing to acquire more petition signers and continuing to deliver that information to further encourage that activity. And then subsequent to a hope for declaration of candidacy or announcement of candidacy, when he is in fact a candidate, the organization is certainly going to be using that list to communicate in support of him.
So you push back on my use of the phrase asset, and that's fair, because the position of Ready for Ron, as I understand it, is that this doesn't have value. Within the technical term thing of value under our statute. I guess my question is, you would agree that mailing lists have been considered a thing of value almost since the initiation of the agency. Are you aware of precedent that I am not holding that a mailing list would not be a thing of value?
I don't know that I would describe this as a mailing list. It is a list of individuals who support a candidate, whether, what it's used for, and it's certainly not just by mail. There's phone numbers, there's emails, there's mailing addresses. But the fact that that any piece of information can be commercially appended and then used for other purposes doesn't make it that other purpose. It's just a list of people who support this individual running for office.
But it also has the contact information, correct?
Yes, because again, we think it's impossible to rely on the credibility of a communication that doesn't have that.
But you don't intend to apply any, this is asked and answered, but you don't intend to apply any restrictions on its use for fundraising.
No, because again, if we're telling a candidate what they should and shouldn't be doing in terms of how they communicate to the general public, that gets us into IE territory, or sorry, into coordinated communication territory. And because the organization intends to conduct independent expenditures when he is a candidate, we don't want to do that.
And my sympathy is very much for the complexity of this area of the law. But I guess what I'm struggling with is, this is a list of at least electronic mailing information and phone numbers and other ways of contacting people. And yet Ready for Ron is taking a position that is not what's called a contact list instead of a mailing list. And I'm wondering what's the best argument for that position, because it seems a little contrary to at least common sense to me. If there's precedent, I'd be interested in it.
Well, I mean, I think on some level it is common sense. For example, if I went up to Governor DeSantis today and said, sir, my name is Dan Backer, my email is such and such, and I want you to run for president, please do. Well, now he has my email. And if a lot of people do that, that isn't a membership list, and it isn't a contributor list. It's a list of people who are expressing support. Can he use that information in other ways? Absolutely. I can take, realistically, every piece of data is available in some commercial database anyway. So you can take any piece of information of a number of people and use that information to generate an asset of value in conducting political activity. But it doesn't mean that information in and of itself was valuable to begin with in the context of a thing of value for the FEC. So for example, You know, if everyone who attends a rally, a political rally, let's say you have an open air rally and people are there, you don't know who's there, but you can, you're using geolocation data, tag everyone's IMEI address of everyone's cell phone who's in attendance and basically get a complete list of every single person who was at that rally. And then append that data with commercially available data for email, mailing address, and phone numbers in order to communicate them. So is their sheer, is their presence at the rally itself a thing of value? Or is it the fact that you're using the existence of an instance of a political speech and association to apply data to it, and the data that you're applying to it and how you use that data becomes a thing of value? Well, I guess it's a little convoluted because, again, it's, you know, we're using terms of art here, but this is a list of people who are saying, I want you to run for office. And we're simply, we're the ones who are collecting that data and handing it over to him to get him to run for office.
So I think that's right, and largely my concern, and that leaving aside the any existential terror one may feel about your geolocation example, you're right, I think, that a single email or a single piece of data of that sort is not what we would think of as a thing of value under the law. But it's precisely that collating process you just described that transforms it into what we've called mailing lists in the past, if you agreed or a thing of value. And so I guess I'd be curious to your response to this idea that, I mean, Ready for Ron, according to the request, is spending 5 digits a month trying to build this list. Presumably it's doing that because it has some value. It intends to keep the list on the back end, presumably because it has value to the organization, after it's been delivered to Governor DeSantis. At what moment during this accretive process of building this list, does it have value? Because it seems like you would agree that at least once Ready for Ron starts using it for its own purposes after delivering it to Governor DeSantis, that it would have value.
I would say that Ready for Ron's use of the list today has value for it today, but it's not simply there's an email address that comes in and that's all there is to it. The value is the contextual information related to that individual and the ongoing engagement. So for example, every single email that you open, and in many cases, if you use Outlook and the images appear on your screen when you're just scrolling through, you've opened it. Every time you open an email, every time you click on an email, which link you click on, what time of day you click on, do you donate, do you not donate, that information when measured against your preferences in commercial databases, there's an enormous amount of activity that occurs after you sign the petition that says, I want Ron DeSantis to run for president. And it's that subsequent activity that is a thing of value that is valuable to Ready for Ron, but it's not the thing that is being given to Governor DeSantis. What's being given is the information directly provided by those individuals. So Dan Backer, and if it's, you know, a phone number or an email or an address, whatever that piece of the petition signing process is, that's the part that ought to be delivered to the individual who they're trying to draft as a speech and associative act. Whereas all the things that the Ready for Ron is going to use that information for and apply to that data, that is a massive amount of activity and information. That's a very valuable asset that it doesn't intend to share with anyone.
So let me unpack that.
Yes.
Well, step one, I mean, it's this is all speech and association. I mean, the part of Buckley that no one reads anymore, you know, of course, is that the first, you know, many pages of the court, you know, explains that everything this commission does is speech and association and not conduct. And you know, there's a sense in which the entire mission of this agency is an accepted exception to the First Amendment's protections. So I take that point, but I think it may prove too much. Back to the list. Let's put aside the way in which it's put together. Just from the point of view of the recipient, what is the difference to, and I'm not going to characterize the recipient, so that's another legal question to back that. But, you know, whoever the recipient is, once they get this list, what is the difference in the underlying, forget asset, the object, the platonic thing that we're talking about that is being received? I mean, you've got a list with contact information. How is that different from the point of view of the recipient from any other list of contact information that we would consider a mailing list under our precedents?
Because these are individuals who are signing a petition calling for the object of their affection to run for president, and they're communicating that directly to that individual. and providing a meaningful point of contact, address, phone, or email in the process of doing so. That act, I think, takes it out of the context of this is just a mailing list. You know, I can go and buy a mailing list, you know, all day long. I remember vaguely about 20 years ago, you could go into Staples and they had CD-ROMs back when we had such things of 20 million business contacts right there at the checkout register. It was, you know, so those are mailing lists. Those are assets. Those are things of value. I don't think there is a fundamental difference between the aggregation of all these different forms of petition signing with, for example, a volunteer taking printing it out and by themselves on a clipboard, going down to the supermarket and actually asking people to sign the petition and then mailing it in. There isn't a fundamental difference there other than the fact that Ready for On is slightly more organized and, you know, it is approaching this at a bigger scale. But at the end of the day, it's the same kind of expressive act. And I don't think there's anything that allows the commission, or I don't think there's a precedent the commission can say volunteers can't solicit people to sign a petition calling for the election of a candidate to office or to run to draft them at a supermarket. And so there's no real difference other than the fact that we are spending slightly more money than the piece of paper and the clipboard and the stamp to send it.
I mean, I have one follow-up and then I have other questions. I'm happy to defer to my colleagues about the monopolizing the table. I mean, that's fair, but would you characterize Ready for On as equivalent to volunteers in that example?
Given the large number of volunteers involved in the organization, yes. Because when I did this sort of activity as a college student, ironically enough, for Massburg's effort to pass campaign finance reform in Massachusetts back in the 90s, I was a volunteer. And there was a paid person who was organizing this, but I was still a volunteer. And the presence of a few paid individuals doesn't mitigate the fact that it is still volunteer activity. It's still people engaged in personal political speech and association and a very expressive conduct.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thank you for your patience.
Thank you. This is just one question. Mr. Backer, we've made a lot of conversation about the list and we've made a lot of conversation about the desire to make sure that the credibility of the list, and that's why we have the email addresses and the telephone numbers and the address. Why wouldn't Ready for Lawn, with the abundance of volunteers, just check to make sure that the names on the list are all credible and then just turn the list over to potentially to solicit Governor DeSantis for running for office?
Well, we have a lot of volunteers, but we're not going to have that many volunteers. I would imagine that is a very substantive process to go through. And frankly, asking the volunteer to sit there and do it is not the easiest thing in the world.
So you don't intend to check the credibility until you send the list over. That would be the potential DeSantis candidacy. Or testing the waters, that would be testing the credibility of those members.
Well, when we say credibility, the concern that I have is if I could just sit here and write out a list of 1,000 names and hand it over to you, and that's not, you know, that's still one person. And so having that point of contact as part of the petition process is, in some level, it assures to us that this is actually somebody who's communicating this. Now, we're also communicating back to those people. So we're getting bounced email addresses or phone numbers that don't respond. I mean, that's information that we can use to strike names off a list if they're fake names, essentially. And of course, I've never done any form of political activity where somebody didn't write something clever and profane on the list. It's on the petition itself. But I don't think our ability to do that internally and for our function is the same as their ability to say, hey, these people want you to run. Well, okay, are these real people? But I don't think we ought to be in the business of telling them we have personally vetted each one of these individuals. And we can guarantee you that every single one of these people is a real person. We call them up afterwards. But then we're expending effort to create an act.
They're already expending effort to collect the names of all of these individuals and their email and their telephones and their addresses so that you can also continue to use the list afterwards.
We're expending effort to allow them to communicate that information to the object of their affection. That we're also going to use that information. But again, the goal here is to allow individuals who want to draft a candidate to be able to communicate that desire that candidate run, that potential candidate run, to that potential candidate.
I do understand the goal, but you also made mention of the request. Will you continue to provide this list? You're going to continue to find individuals to support. So going through the election cycle, this would be an ongoing list that's going to be turned over to the DeSantis.
We think that is both permissible and appropriate. Obviously, we're asking the question to make sure that we're not running afoul of federal election law here, though we feel very confident that it is permissible to continue to do so.
But at a certain point in time, Mr. DeSantis, if he should get into that formal testing the waters or become a candidate, mm-hmm. at that point in time, would you stop? Because we have some concerns about excessive contributions.
No, because our belief is that we are still able to continue to provide him the names of individuals who want him to run in much the same way as when we receive a conduit contribution from an individual and forward it on to any candidate in any political action committee, we're also forwarding along various other information with it.
And will you continue to use your non-contribution and contribution accounts to do this?
Probably one or both. Yeah, we'd have to if we're spending money. So. I can't tell you the exact ratio of spending between one account and the other account, but I don't believe that it's necessarily, I don't believe it's a dispositive consideration because at the end of the day, communicate these, all these petition signatures are in response to the communication that we have put out there. And so the, when they're responding to our communications, how we pay for that communication, I think is independent from the act of the individual receiving the communication.
Thank you, colleagues, let me pause. Mr. Trainer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Backer, is I think in response to a question that we had presented to you, you said there's about a little under 50,000 signatures so far collected on the petition. Does it change your evaluation of whether or not the names have a value if you attach the geographic data to those particular names? In such a way that they become useful to somebody who's running for president. So for example, if all 50,000 of those names are in Iowa, where the caucuses will be held and roughly, you know, 150,000 people vote in the Iowa caucus, does 50,000 names in Iowa have a different value to a presidential candidate than say 50,000 names spread out across the United States?
So two-part answer. The first is, if we append information to a set of data, so we basically go to a commercial vendor and pay whatever, 5-8 cents a record to add that information, then yes, that makes it an asset that would, you know, a thing of value. The fact that there are people in one particular state or more people in one state than another, I don't think changes the underlying nature, however. You know, certainly as volunteers begin doing events, if you happen to have more volunteers in Iowa and New Hampshire, where people are more politically engaged, I don't think that really changes. And even if it was an effort to paid effort to acquire more information in Iowa and New Hampshire, I don't necessarily think that is that's going to change the underlying fact that this is an expressive act and a piece and conduct from individuals who want to tell an individual that they want him to run for president, and that we are simply conveying that information to that person.
Thank you.
This is very weird. You should put a TV up in the center.
It's even harder to moderate. Colleagues, let me ask you a couple follow-ups. Let me start with your response to Commissioner Traynor. So I think we all agree that if you have something and you have to go on the open market to supplement that, then the value, the price you pay on the open market to supplement it is relevant to both whether it's a thing of value and to the valuation thereof. But I guess my concern is there's some point in the supply chain where the original product has to be produced. And so I to analogize, and I'm making this up on the fly, so there may be problems with the analogy. But you know, the fact that, you know, you bring in iron ore and then you have to, you know, pay for the coal or the electricity, and you have to pay for the labor for the smelting process, and you have to pay for the rent on the land on which you're doing the smelting to make steel, doesn't change the fact that somewhere back in the process, someone had to mine the iron ore out of the earth. And that's not, you didn't acquire the iron ore on the market, you produced it through a production process. And so I guess to me, again, by analogy, I mean, isn't the underlying list of names and addresses, which I agree you're producing yourself, you're spending money to do it. And it just seems like that's the iron ore. Like the fact you're not purchasing the iron ore directly, you're just taking it from the bowels of the earth yourself. You're mixing your labor with it in this very like Lockean sense. Doesn't change the fact, going back to first principles, that the iron ore still has value once you've extracted it.
So I would use a different analogy, one of honeybees. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a thriving business of commercial honeybees, and you go to a commercial honeybee keeper, you pay him money, he brings his bees, they pollinate your crop. And there are still plenty of people in all around the world and here in this country who don't do that and still have honeybees that pollinate their crops. And so in essence, these things exist in nature, and valuable processes occur whether or not you have anything to do with it. And then you go and you pick those flowers and you haven't paid for any of that. And so the iron ore analogy works because it's the analogy you want to use, but I think it, so does the honeybee analogy. And at the end of the day, within the confines of federal election law, this is political speech and a political association and an expressive act. And the fact that we have evolved a infrastructure by which we were going to facilitate individuals communicating to the object of their affection, their desire that he runs, I think puts it outside the scope of the definition of a contribution or a thing of value under the act. And I can, and thinking about the comments earlier, you know, this goes on all day long. Act Blue is a WinRed both acquire massive amounts of data, and they provide information beyond the scope of what is necessary for simple FEC compliance to the recipients of contributions through Act Blue and WinRed. They get email addresses, they get phone numbers, neither of which are required for FEC reporting. They get information on individuals who don't aggregate in excess of $200, and they still get that information because, and none of that is a thing of value. It's just part of the expressive act. It is contingent or associated with the expressive conduct of making a contribution. And here we're talking about not a contribution, but these are people who are saying, I want you to run for president, and they have every right to say it. They have every right to communicate that to him. The fact that there's a mechanism to do so efficiently that has money invested in that infrastructure of doing so doesn't make it any less expressive conduct.
I mean, I don't disagree this is expressive conduct, because everything we do is expressive conduct.
Expressive conduct outside the scope of the act.
Right. I mean, that's the problem with the argument, is that, like, I agree with you. I mean, very, very strongly that, you know, everything that we do here under the act is expressive and associational conduct. But I'm bound by court orders that say I have to draw these distinctions. So going back to your honeybee analogy, that's a good one, and I'll spare you the Virgil. But I really like that example, because I think it's right. Like, if you go up to Governor DeSantis and you say, hey, Governor, I'm Dan Bakker, here's my email address. You're the solitary honeybee, fair. You're the wild honeybee out there, you know, in the commons, pollinating flowers. Cool, good to go. But there's a market if you don't have enough wild honeybees showing up to pollinate your crops. And that market is you bring in more honeybees that are commercially owned, and you spend money in order to make sure there are enough honeybees if there aren't enough in the commons. And that seems like what's happening here. It's like, this isn't solitary honeybees coming in and talking to Governor DeSantis. This is someone spending $10,000 a month to bring in commercial honeybees to pollinate the crops.
In your analogy, and we're going to torture the heck out of this one.
It's what we do.
We're lawyers. Look at us as a farmer. I think we're the colony. And the farmer is the ultimate end recipient, who's the beneficiary of the pollinated crops. But we are, you know, we believe that he should run for president. We are connecting with other people who believe he should run for president. We are working together to communicate that belief to him that he should run for president. And, you know, it's interesting because to the extent that, you know, you're bound by the statute and the code and court orders, you know, here's the thing. There's nothing in the statute at all that talks about draft committees, that even envisions them, as far as I can tell. There's only one mention in the entire CFR. My version is 4 years out of date. I love that I got the new one finally. But the only mention in the CFR about draft committees is to specifically exclude them from regulation when they use the name of the object of their draft. And there's I'm not aware of any MERS or any court orders that specifically address this idea that, you know, you have to, you know, if you're trying to draft somebody, you're regulated. You can't do this. In fact, principally the main reason that we are registered as a political committee is that part of the message of why we want Ron DeSantis to run for president is that Joe Biden is just awful. And so we are calling for the defeat of a clearly identified federal candidate in 2024 as part of the message that you know, we need to defeat him. So let's get him elected. And because those are independent expenditures, when we spend money on it, that, you know, that requires, and I'm certainly not arguing that we're subject to registration and the independent expenditure reporting requirements as a consequence of that. So that part of this conduct that we're engaged in requires the registration. But the fact that we have to register and report this one piece of our activity doesn't open up all the rest of this other activity that would otherwise be not regulated, it's not even thought of here, to sudden regulation. It's essentially saying, you know, you can do this by yourself, you can do it collectively, but you can't do it too much collectively, because when you do, then we have to stop and get to stand it and stop it. And I don't think there's any applicable law that goes towards that point.
Well, and I think that is the hard question here. I agree with you. It's, you know, I assume for purposes of the questions I'm about to ask, that this is a thing of value under the Act. Just, I understand it's not your position, but you know, assume it for argument. I want to rephrase a question that Commissioner Broussard asked you, which is, you know, the problem here, the really hard problem here, and the one that I'm, you know, in all frankness, struggling with, is that we don't know Governor DeSantis's status. And frankly, I'm not sure you do either.
I can only go by published press reports, including today, that said that does not have him saying he's a candidate. Being asked and not saying he is a candidate or testing the waters. And in fact, he has repeatedly said this, and I'm not aware of any human being who has actually heard him say, yes, I'm running.
No, fair enough.
And so that would be in the press.
But that's not actually my question, which is, you know, Commissioner Broussard asked you, well, what happens when you start verifying these people? I mean, that's work that has to be done. And you said, well, that's a problem for them. So my first question is, who did you mean by them? And relatedly, and I think this is fair to her question, but I'm curious for myself, is verifying the names and contact information of a list of people who support you running for president itself testing the waters activity?
Well, the them would be, the first part is easy. Them is he as an individual, and were he to be creating an organization for this purpose, presumably he would delegate that function to them, to that
sure.
them.
Yeah.
I don't know that it is. You know, I don't know that it's necessarily testing the waters information, because, you know, you can have a thought like, boy, I'd love to run for president. I want to run for president. It doesn't make you a candidate. It doesn't mean you're testing the waters. There's a wide range of thinking about and talking to people that occurs before one is a candidate. And I remember mentioning this. So a couple of years ago, the commission at the old office had a rulemaking. And I remember being on the panel and we were talking about something unrelated to this, but then Jeb Bush came up. And it was during in 2015. And there was a lot, I think it was the internet rulemaking. And the question came up, and one of the panelists from, I think, CL Camping Legal Center said something along the lines that, you know, Jeb Bush is a candidate. And my point was like, well, no, he's not. He's, you know, he may or may not be testing the waters, but he's not a candidate. And whether or not somebody is testing the waters, I mean, you have regulations that say what you can and cannot do during that time. And that, you know, there is to a lesser extent than as a candidate. But just because you're talking to people about running for office doesn't mean you're testing the water. Just because people are talking to you about running for office doesn't mean you're testing the water. You know, a million people could sign the petition and we could hand it over to him today and he can look at that. And it doesn't mean he's testing the waters. It means he is receiving information. And I think, you know, the commission grappled with this a little bit in I believe an enforcer matter where information was provided to representatives of the Trump campaign in Trump Tower. And the question was whether this information constitutes a thing of value. And I believe the outcome was that no, it's not. That information itself is not a thing of value in sort of in the ether. But that the fact that they were getting this information didn't suddenly make it a campaign activity. And more importantly, I think at the end of the day, the fact that people are talking about it, I mean, people are talking about him all day long as, you know, is he running? Is he not? It's a favorite sport in Washington and in the media. None of it means he's testing the waters, because testing the waters is something that he in some level must affirmatively do. And I don't believe for a second that simply being told or asked to run or being told to run or thinking about, boy, should I run? That's just not enough.
So with the premise that our testing the waters regulations are not a model of clarity, which, as you know, is lawyer for their disaster, I'll grant you that, but it doesn't change the fact that, as you say, and I agree with you, you know, Governor DeSantis's status as a candidate or status as someone testing the waters to become a candidate is a Governor DeSantis thing, right? It's not someone from the outside necessarily making that determination. It's a determination he and his, you know, team presumably make at some point in time. And there's all sorts of very difficult questions of proof under our current regulation. And that's a problem that we have inherited, both me in this position and you in yours. But the problem I have is that I'm being asked to make assumptions about his status for purposes of this AO, and I don't have any representative of Governor DeSantis here. I don't have his view on how this transfer would work. I don't have any sort of declaration or other evidence of any kind as to his status. I agree with you that I haven't seen any press reports that he is running for president, but I don't read every possible press report. I have a job, and there's a large universe of potential press reports. So I mean, there's an unknown unknowns problem, to quote a former Secretary of Defense, where I'm a little uncomfortable that we are being very speculative about the status of the recipient here. So with that worry in front of you, I'm curious as to your response.
I don't think my rights to freedom of speech and freedom of association or those of anybody else ought to be cabined on unknown, unknowable. If he is a candidate, that is a known thing. You file an FEC Form 2, you file an FEC Form 1, you create a committee, you announce. That is a knowable. I grant you that there's a gray area around testing the waters, but it seems to me that the bulk of the regulations around testing the waters was really designed to prevent people from being candidates without being candidates. And so it limited the activities that one could do. You can't do general public advertising, and you can only accept money for the purposes that within the scope of the act to engage in this activity. But it doesn't seem to me that testing the waters is a unique and special status that was created other than as a mechanism against the circumvention by a potential candidate of contribution limits and reporting requirements.
No, I think that's broadly right. And that's why I started this conversation by asking whether a particular activity would be testing the waters activity. And it was a sincere question because I don't know the answer, either under the regulation or in terms of our precedents.
I don't think it matters whether he is testing the waters or not, because I still have a right, whether he's testing the waters or not, I can still walk up to him and say, my name is Dan Bakker, my email is such and such, I would like you to run for president. And whether or not he's testing waters, my right is still there. I can go and volunteer and print out a petition and walk over to Staples or the Starbucks and get people to sign that message, and then I can mail it to him. All of that is still well within my right. I'm sending money to do so. There's paper, there's ink, there's stamp. The gas money alone to get to the local Starbucks is at least $20 these days. And so there is effort and expenditure being made. The fact that multiple people work together to do this and to pool their resources to effectively engage in this expressive act of conduct does not suddenly mean that, should not make it impermissible, nor are their rights to do so cabined by whether or not he has achieved the status. We still have the right to engage in this activity.
No, and again, I think we share some basic premises here, one of which is you're absolutely right. People getting together and pooling money and resources and volunteer time to engage in politics are engaging in constitutionally protected speech and association. The problem is that's true of any political committee. And I'm having, that doesn't necessarily answer why is this particular activity outside of the act. So let me ask one final question.
Can I say that?
Yeah, please.
Because the act does not talk about this at all.
Well, and that is going to be my question, which is, I appreciated you explaining why Ready for Ron is a political committee, particularly a hybrid committee, or a Kerry committee, since I've got counsel for Admiral Kerry here. But the fact is that was helpful because it clarified why Ready for Ron is structured the way it is. And I think carries back to the fact that I did not come into this hearing really understanding the post-delivery uses of the list to which Ready for Ron intended to put it. That may be a failure of my research, but that's new to me. And so I guess my question is this. Your client is a political committee. A political committee may use funds for any lawful purpose. And the best understanding of your legal theory, I think, is, again, assuming the thing of value, which I understand is not your position, but assuming it, and assuming that you're right, that, and I think you are, that not everyone who receives something is testing the waters or a candidate as a matter of law. But that just means that the theory of the request is a political committee can make a gift of arguably a substantially valuable thing to just a private citizen, just some guy. And I don't know what the legal basis is for that as a thing that a political committee can do. And so I guess my question to you is, do you have authority for the concept that a political committee can just make a gift to a private individual unrelated to, any sort of candidacy or testing the waters? I mean, what's the theory there?
Well, two answers. First is to the extent that this private individual is not related to the organization, it doesn't get into the matter of personal enrollment, and therefore it is not unlawful, and it is any other lawful activity. And so the statute allows the organization and the regs to engage in any other lawful activity. It doesn't really make sense for a political organization to just give a gift to somebody in that context. So I don't, it would be very odd if it were to occur. But at the same time, that's also not what's happening here. A group of individuals who are required to register with the Federal Election Commission in order to conduct their independent expenditure activity as a part of their broader speech is telling an individual that they want him to run for office. And I think we're trying to put something into the statute and into the code and into the construct here when it's not. It isn't in the statute. It's not in the code. The only reference to the code is to exclude it from coverage in the code. There's no court case that talks about this. I imagine the commission has had opportunities to think about this in the past. There was draft Biden 2016. There was the draft Ben Carson movement. There was draft Sheriff Joe Clark. There have been other draft movements in the past. I don't know what they did. I wasn't involved in those, but I'm just saying that there have clearly been efforts to engage in draft activities. And despite that, there's nothing. There's no law that really talks to the commission's ability to regulate what is a different kind of expressive conduct than what is the normal function of a political activity, which is raising money to contribute to candidates, to convey express political messages, and to call for the election to defeat a political candidate. And right. We're a political committee because we don't have a choice because of some of our activity. It sure. Shouldn't preclude our ability to engage in this other thing that, if we didn't do IEs, would we even have to register? I mean, that's an interesting question. If we didn't conduct independent expenditures calling for the defeat of Joe Biden in 2024, would we even have to register as a political committee? Now, the flip side, by the way, is there's an enormous value to the public to see all this, to have the transparency that exists here, and that and to be able to, see exactly how the money is being spent. And I for one, think, having seen the draft movements develop over the years, I think it's a great thing that draft organizations are actually in a position to have to turn this information over to the object of their affection. I think it's probably better for the public and better for campaign finance law generally that people can't say, yes, let's draft Bob, and they don't actually give Bob the list of names of people trying to draft them.
So first, my compliments on the phrase object of their affection, which I have been enjoying. I'm not sure that answers my question. So let me take it out of the list context. Like pretend that it's not something valuable to the campaign at all, even in theory, right? Imagine that instead of a list of name and contact information, Ready for On spends $10,000 to $15,000 a month hiring a wood carver to just make a spectacularly filigreed plaque of the text of the First Amendment.
I know a guy.
For presentation, and I'll get that name from you later. But and then they spend $50,000 on this just gorgeous piece of original woodwork, and just give it to Governor DeSantis. Totally useless for a presidential campaign, but we really want you to run, and we think you're a great supporter of the First Amendment. So here's just an object. Here is an expression of our affection for the object of our affection. Can a political committee do that? Just give a $50,000 wood carving to someone?
If he's not a federal candidate or office holder, there's not a prohibition in the statute against doing so if there is an expressive political purpose behind it. I don't know that it can't be done. I do think it would be on the one hand, it would be very weird to do. On the other hand, I know a chainsaw wood artist who does these things for political people. So, but it doesn't strike me as a sort of normal thing to do. But yeah, I think I can't think off the top of my head that there is a requirement that a political committee cannot communicate that thought to somebody. Now, having said that, there may be state level, if it's a state office, there's probably state ethics issues and laws that may apply as well that are independent of the federal law, but I don't think federal law prohibits that. Unless there's personal enrollment at play.
No, fair. And I guess just my last question then, you've been very patient, thank you. Would state ethics laws, bribery laws, gift laws, fill in the blank laws be read into FICA's any lawful purpose restriction on PAC funds?
That is an interesting question, but I don't know that they would necessarily would. There's some authority on this, and I don't know it off the top of my head. But for example, there are states that prohibit the transfer funds between committees for use in federal races, and there are some that don't, and that's been an issue that's been, I think it's been basically passed over by the commission. The commission hasn't ruled on one way or the other on state law. So I don't know that goes into the applicable, any other lawful purpose. But on the other hand, if there's a law that prohibits it at a state level, I think there may very well be a strong presumption that it would be impermissible for the federal PAC to violate a state law. So I think I'd have to think about it a little bit more and look at the precedent. I'm not aware of any prosecution to that effect, though.
Have you looked into state law on this?
We are comfortable that the course of conduct is not going to violate state law.
Thank you very much, colleagues. Mr. Broussard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the wood carving or whatever you guys call it, if it was given for the purpose of influencing Governor DeSantis to run, isn't that the category? How did they give the wood in your example? Like, they just gave it? Or did they say, we're giving this for the incentive for him to run for office? What is the purpose of the list giving it over with, if it's not to influence or for his consideration to run for office?
The purpose of giving over the petitions is precisely to influence him in order to run for office.
If he accepts it, then he is considering and evaluating whether he is running for office, which means that he's considering whether he's testing the waters and where now.
If he accepts it, he accepts it. Plenty of people accept gifts as a courtesy and not to be rude. If he accepts it with the intent of, well, let me think about this, I don't think that makes it mean he's testing the water. Plenty of people are testing, are thinking about running for office all day long, and they're not testing the waters. And so the mere acceptance by him of a list of people who want him to run for federal office doesn't mean he's testing the waters. And even if he is testing the waters, I don't think that there is a basis to prohibit individuals from communicating their desire that he run for office because he's testing the water. I think if I can go out and do this petition drive as a volunteer, and thousands of my friends can do so as volunteers, I mean, if that is lawful activity, it doesn't suddenly become unlawful because he's testing the waters. And so I don't think there is a substantial difference between a bunch of volunteers going to supermarkets and asking people to sign a petition that they mail to him and an organization that is doing that in a slightly more efficient manner.
Okay. It's all for the purpose of influencing him to run for office.
Of influencing him to decide to run for office.
And if he's deciding and in the process of trying to decide whether he's going to run or not, that is kind of in the testing the waters.
Well, I guess the corollary would be is Joe Biden testing the waters.
We're not talking about that.
Well, I know, this is the problem. Here's somebody who is a sitting office holder who regularly talks about running for office in 2024. I think he's a candidate,
Mr. Backer,
he hasn't had a red. Well, again,
Mr. Backer, what I had asked you was in the field of what we're looking for and the facts that we have. Can you answer that question based upon the facts that we're talking about?
Yes, I don't believe that there is anything in that the fact that somebody is thinking about running for office means they are testing the waters. Testing the waters involves more action. It involves raising money in order, subject to the contribution limits, to engage in activity that apparently requires money in order to do this. This is somebody receiving an expression of people's political speech, association, expressive conduct, saying, hey, we want you to run for office. The fact that he's just receiving it doesn't somehow make him a candidate or make him testing the waters. And I don't think there's anything in the statute that would indicate that.
My next question I want to ask you is the concern, do we not have a concern about this coming from two types of accounts? It's a carry account. So if he accepts this and then he goes into the category where he's decided that he's going to run for office, don't we have a problem now?
No, I don't believe that we do, because how we pay for the communications of encouraging people to engage in to sign this petition is separate from the act of them signing the petition.
But I guess that comes down to the question whether a contribution is being made or not.
And our position is that it's not a contribution because it is materially distinct from membership and donorship.
Thank you.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did not think we were going to be spending this much time about whether it was a thing of value, since both drafts actually agree on that point. Do you acknowledge, Mr. Backer, that we have, as the chairman pointed out, longstanding rules about mailing lists, and that under our regulations, mailing lists are a thing of value?
Yes, I'm aware that those rules exist.
And is your position that, well, what if you had street addresses on this list, in addition to email addresses and phone numbers, if you had street addresses, would you say that that was a mailing list?
Not in the context in which the FEC uses that term, because I think that a mailing list is developed for the purposes of sending political mail, fundraising mail to individuals. The value of it is that it's a data work. What we have here is not just the fact that it has addresses doesn't change the fact that it's individuals signing a petition expressing their preference that he run for office. I think that it takes it out of the scope of those regulations.
So you think that a list of names and addresses and mailing addresses is not a mailing list?
In this context, the fact that it is a list of names and mailing addresses is different than a mailing list that is an asset used by a committee to raise money. It's just a different thing. And we can't ignore the fact that this list exists because individuals are signing a petition to tell Governor DeSantis they want him to run for office, as is their right. The fact that
is there any precedent that when we're looking at a mailing list, we look at the reasons why people's names showed up on the list in terms of deciding whether it's a mailing list?
I'm not aware of the precedent.
Neither am I.
But it's not just a mailing. But again, it's not a mailing list. It doesn't exist for the purpose of being mailed to. It is a list that exists for the purpose of telling somebody to run for office. If the position is any list is automatically a mailing list, then there's no possible way to ever engage in draft conduct, because you can't draft somebody if you can't communicate the effect that, hey, we want you to run for office and here are our names. And you can't do that because you might have a mailing information on there. Therefore, it's now a mailing list. It is over broadly sweeping vast areas of activity other than, I think, the activity that this was intended to cover, which is fundraising mailing lists.
That is a really interesting theory, Mr. Backer, but there's absolutely no precedent for that interpretation of the word mailing.
There's also no precedent that a draft committee list is a mailing
list. Both drafts rightly, I believe, say that this is a thing of value, a mailing list, and it is a thing of value. I'm interested in another issue, which is the actual difference between the two drafts. And that goes to what can be provided to someone before they declare their candidacy if you don't know whether they are testing the waters or not. Could someone give $1 million to a prospective candidate and that candidate then turns around the next day and says, well, I wasn't going to run for office until I got that $1 million. Now that I have this $1 million, I'm going to at least test the waters to see. Would that be legal?
Not going to get into that. I think it's outside the scope of what we're discussing here. And I'm not aware of that being something that has occurred.
Well, I think it actually is within the scope of what we're talking about here, or not what we've been talking about so far, but within the scope of the draft. Because if one could provide a thing of value to a candidate who has not yet declared his candidacy, then I don't see what the legal distinction would be between the one thing of value and another, the cash or the mailing. But having said that,
I could address that point. The difference is that cash is cash, and the Supreme Court says that the giving of money in political purposes is maybe regulated, whereas signing a petition asking somebody to run for federal office is an expressive conduct. And
there
so it is
distinct. There is such a thing as an in-kind contribution. It's not just cash. Having said that, I'm going to be supporting draft A. I think it's the most consistent draft with the current state of law. I have no other questions.
Of course. Colleagues, further questions? Are there any motions? Mr. Weintraub.
Did I say one, please?
I'm happy to. Madam Vice Chair, I think I saw your hand.
Sure, happy to make a motion. An advisory opinion, 2022-12, ready for Ron. I move approval of agenda document number 22-36-A, which is draft A.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Discussion of the motion? Let me just preview where I'm going. I will not be able to support the motion. I have some sympathy for where my colleagues are coming from, but I actually agree with Mr. Backer that the draft A, in my view, shortens the analysis on whether it is not clear to me as a matter of law that giving a list to a candidate automatically transforms that candidate into someone who's testing the waters. And that step seems to be missing in the analysis from draft B for me. So for that explanation, I'll be voting no on the motion. Further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails with 3 in favor, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Broussard, and Commissioner Weintraub, and 3 opposed, Commissioner Cooksey, Commissioner Traynor, and myself. Further motions. Commissioner Cooksey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to draft advisory opinion 2022-12, ready for Ron, I move approval of agenda document number 22-36-B, which is draft B.
Thank you, Commissioner. Discussion of the draft, or excuse me, of the motion on the draft. Well, let me just say I'm going to oppose this motion as well, because as this conversation has indicated to me, I just think that the Act talks about advisory opinions for specific transactions or activities, and the facts here are too amorphous for you to be comfortable giving an advisory opinion. So for that reason, I'll just be voting no here. Further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails with 2 in favor, Commissioner Cooksey and Commissioner Traynor, and 4 opposed, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Broussard, Commissioner Weintraub, and myself. Any further motions? Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure this requires a motion, but since there is some overlap between the two drafts, I wasn't planning on doing it as a motion. Would you prefer it as a motion?
Always.
All right, fine. I move that the commission direct the staff to prepare a response that answers the parts of the question where the two drafts overlap and then says that we couldn't agree on the rest.
Thank you, Commissioner. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passes with 4 in favor. Myself, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Broussard, and 2 opposed, Commissioner Cooksey and Commissioner Traynor. Any further motions, Mr. Weintraub?
It's not a motion, just a comment that that area of agreement is that the list, or whatever you want to call it, could not be provided once Governor DeSantis, if and when he is testing the waters, which is an open question at this point. So if he is testing the waters, then you can't provide the information to him under the draft that the commission just
there. Well, and to clarify, we're still going to have to vote on that draft, and there have not been 4 votes for any theory on that. So we'll handle that at a later point down the road.
A procedural question. When there is a subsequent draft, is that made public for public comment prior to its vote, or is it done on a tally vote, which normally is in the historically, I've always seen these as tally votes, but there are differences between the two drafts on those 2 questions that I think we may want to comment on depending on the final version.
My understanding, and I'm happy to throw it over to council, is that it would go through on tally if there were unanimity, but any objections would bring it to a public meeting.
That's correct. And if we needed another public meeting, then we would also need an extension from the requester.
Which the requester will grant.
Thank you all very much. Any further discussion on this matter? Our thanks to council for a especially substantive discussion.
Thank you very much.